Morning, Council. You ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, and I believe Chancellor Neville. May it please the court, my name is Mike Teachman. I'm from the law firm of Parkowski, Gergen, Swayze. We represent the appellant FP International, or Free Flow Packaging International. If the court will indulge, I'm asked to reserve 5 minutes of my time for a rebuttal. As I discussed at the last time we were here before the panel, this case really revolves around the fact that Denrick staff in early 1999 developed in private a methodology or a set of criteria that Denrick would use to assign Title V sources to base fee categories under what would become Section 6097D of Title VII. They did this without ever exposing that criteria to public scrutiny, and they did it without ever exposing, or strike that, without ever setting the methodology or the criteria that they used down into a writing that could be applied uniformly from one case to the next. We think that that's just plain wrong and that it violates the law, and that's why we've taken this appeal. Now, the last time we, the appellant, were here before a panel, we focused on two of three arguments that were set forth in our brief. And with the court's permission, we'd like to do that again. Of course, we're ready to answer any questions that you might have about the third argument. But what I would like to focus on is the first two arguments, which are the failure of Denrick to follow the Administrative Procedures Act and Denrick's violation of this court's rule in Butler versus Insurance Commissioner. And what I'm hopeful to do today is focus my presentation on some of the questions that the court raised during the last argument. I think one of the questions that came up, I think repeatedly, was whether or not this statute was sufficiently specific such that the secretary wouldn't need to adopt implementing regulations. In other words, when this statute says secretary shall estimate time spent performing services, is that sufficiently specific? Well, I think we can all agree that there's lots of ways to estimate things. I can look at this podium and based on my 40 years of measuring things, I can estimate that it looks about to be 2 feet. Another way to estimate that is to go and look at every single podium in courts in the state of Delaware that are similar, take precise measurements, and take the arithmetic mean of those measurements and use that as a basis for my estimate of the width of this podium. So this, and very likely one of those two methods is going to be a lot more accurate than the other. The point I'm trying to make here is there's lots of ways to estimate, and this particular statute doesn't give the secretary any guidance into how he is to conduct those estimates. The question really isn't answered by the fact, the question of whether a regulation is necessary is not answered by the fact that this section, Section 6097D, doesn't explicitly require the adoption of regulations in order to be implemented. In fact, most agency regulations are not implemented pursuant to a specific statutory requirement. Rather, they are adopted pursuant to a general authorization that the administrative agency has. Indeed, if that were the touchstone, if we had to have a specific requirement that a regulation be adopted in order for what Denrick did to be considered a regulation, the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act, would really be very limited in scope to just those regulations that devolve from a specific statutory mandate rather than the general statutory authorization that all administrative agencies have.
Of course, when there's not a statutory mandate to implement regulations, how does a court decide whether the failure to implement regulations is fatal as opposed to simply being optional? The argument we're hearing from your opponent is that this is a self-executing statute and that you don't need any regulations. You could do it if you wanted to, but it's not necessary, and what they did was consistent with the statute. Where do we look for guidance to find out that there should have been regulations?
Thank you, Your Honor. There's two ways to do that. One, we look at the criteria, the actual process that Denrick used, and see if that fits within the definition of regulation. That's one. And then secondly, we look to see whether the statute is in fact, self-executing. So let me take the first of those. What DANREG did, what they told us they've done, is they developed a criteria that went as follows. Weighed program experience with the source, including the complexity of the source's emissions and control devices, applicable regulatory requirements, and the emissions rate of the source itself. Now let's compare that to what is the definition of regulation under the Administrative Procedures Act. And I'll paraphrase that for you, but it's under 29 Del Code 10102 sub 7. And it reads, relevant to what we're dealing with, a statement of procedure or policy formulated as a rule or standard or as a guide for the decision of cases thereafter. And DANREG's criteria, their methodology, which was never published in a regulation, is exactly that. It was a statement of policy or procedure to be used as a guide, as a standard, in order to decide which Title V source would pay which base fee. So for those reasons, it is, that criteria was a regulation, and the requirements of Subchapter 2 of the Administrative Procedures Act, therefore, must have been complied with, and they weren't. Of course, those are to publish the draft in the Register of Regulations, accept comment from the regulated public, hold a hearing, publish the final draft in the Register of Regulations, etc. None of which, of course, happened. Now, the other way to deal with your question is to look at whether or not it's in fact, this statute was in fact self-executing. Parts of it are, clearly, I think we touched on this the last time the matter was argued, the user fee under Section 6097E. We're really not arguing about that. That is a fee that is based upon an external benchmark, and that external benchmark is the emissions inventory. So every source can know, because it knows where it is on the emissions inventory already, they know exactly what fee they're going to have to pay. And DANREG has no discretion whatsoever to do anything other than invoice the exact fee that corresponds to where the source falls on the emissions inventory. Similarly, for the portion of the statute that we are arguing about, and that's Section 6097D, the base fee portion, there are synthetic miners. These synthetic miners are in a predetermined category. It's a voluntary election. Every synthetic miner knows who they are, and DANREG knows who they are, and DANREG has no discretion to do anything other than to invoice the actual $3,000 fee that the statute sets forth. But now how about all of those sources that aren't synthetic miners? About 100 of them. And free flow is one of them. There's three very different categories and tax brackets into which they could fall based upon these estimates. And there is no guidance within the statute that tells us how to conduct the estimate. So a DANREG first has to figure out how to conduct the estimate and then apply that process to each of these 100 or so sources. And there are many, many variables that DANREG must work through in order to come up with this estimate. Let me touch on those for you. There is, in the base fee portion of the statute, a list of examples of what are base fee services. These are services that are common to all sources.
Could I interrupt you for a second? I may be repeating what Justice Holland already asked, but I'm still a little bit confused about it. For purposes of argument, let's assume that this could have been done by regulation, all right? The fact that it would fit into the definition of a regulation, the fact that it might be appropriate to do this as a regulation, that's one thing. How do you make the jump from the fact that this could have been a regulation to your argument that it had to be a regulation? I'm still missing that.
Your Honor, I think what we're arguing is not only did it have to be a properly adopted regulation, but what it was a regulation, but improperly adopted, because it meets the definition of regulation under the Administrative Procedures Act. And we think when you've got
your position is that, if I understand it correctly, that this fee schedule, or the base fee schedule, has to fit into one of three legal categories. Number one, it could be or is a regulation which would make it subject to the Administrative Procedures Act, and since the Act was not followed, ergo, your side wins. Secondly, it could be not a regulation, but simply the product of a self-executing statute, as Justice Holland asked. But your response to that is the statute's not self-executing, so it can't fit into that category.
Correct.
And then lastly, and this is my question, the only other category it could fit in would be something akin to case adjudication. And if that's what it is, then the adjudication here in your client's case was arbitrary and capricious. Is that right?
Well, that's right, but not to put too fine a point on it, but in order, even if you consider what they did as individual case decisions, they couldn't get to the case decision until they first developed the criteria, the standard that they would use to make that case decision.
For which reason the decision was arbitrary and capricious?
Either it's arbitrary and capricious, or the criteria, if it was appropriate, was the regulation but improperly adopted.
I may have missed your point in your answer to Justice Berger's question, and I apologize if I did, but can you tell us again why there should have been a regulation pursuant to the Administrative Procedures Act, why there had to be one?
Your Honor, we think there had to be one because in this case, well, there had to be a regulation, be it lawful or unlawful. There had to be a process, a formula, a procedure, a criteria, because the statute itself doesn't give DENREG those parameters. So, as I said, there's lots of ways to conduct an estimate, and here there are a lot of variables that DENREC needs to work through.
What compels the need for a regulatory development process? Does it need to be exposed to the public for critique? Is it like a federal reg where it's sent out for comment for a period of time so the people who are to be regulated will have a chance to address whether or not the methodology that's been suggested by the agency is reasonable or unreasonable or working on due hardship or not? Is that the reason it had to be a regulation?
Well, that is. And, of course, that's required under Subchapter 2 of the APA. We have our own process. It's a little different than the federal government, but it's not that much different, where there is the draft regulation is published in the register and the regulated public has a right to comment.
Well, is it the essence of your complaint that had there, in the absence of the development of a regulation with a time for comment and for the people regulated to have some input into the framework under which they would be regulated, that is not intended by the statute and unfair in its application? Is that the essence of it?
That is correct, Your Honor. We think that any time you have a statute like this that can't be implemented without the exercise of some agency discretion, that a regulation must be published.
The operative word in your argument is estimate. And you seem to be saying if a statute calls for an estimate, you automatically need to promulgate a regulation. It appears that an alternative reading would be if a statute calls for an estimate, the estimate has to be reasonable. And the person who thinks they've been treated unfairly says your estimate's unreasonable.
If, Your Honor, the parameters of the estimate were set out in the statute, so if the statute gave us the precise amount of time over which we would conduct the estimate of hours spent performing services, and if the statute gave us the identity of the positions within DENREC for which we would include in our estimate, and so that we would know not to include others, the example being engineers versus support staff.
But doesn't the use of the word by the General Assembly of estimated suggest a certain informality, a certain flexibility, a certain deference to the agency to exercise its discretion to act reasonably?
Absolutely, Your Honor. They have to, because there is no flesh on these bones. So DENREC has to act reasonably, rationally, in order to make the statute work, but they've got to do it through the Administrative Procedures Act process.
But the choice of a word such as estimated suggests to me that the General Assembly wasn't envisioning that a regulation was necessary to implement what it wanted. It was looking for something on an informal basis, as the Department appears to have done.
I guess I would disagree with that, Your Honor. There's just too much latitude here that the agency had to deal with. Are we looking forward, estimating time spent performing services in the future? Are we making that estimate looking backwards? You're going to have very different results. Again, whose hours are we looking at? Are we looking at engineers only? Are we looking at support staff? Are we going to allocate some of the secretary's time? You will get very, very different results depending upon what decisions are made with respect to that. So given that enormous latitude, I think a regulation was absolutely required in this case. Absolutely. It was up to DENREC to sort all this out in order to bring this statute to life, but they had to do it through the Administrative Procedures Act process, subchapter 2.
You acknowledged in response to an earlier question that portions of this statute were self-executing and others were not. Should we read anything into that? Is that a normal way to enact a statutory scheme?
I'm not sure I can answer that. I think there are some statutes that will have a mix of provisions that are self-executing and other provisions that are not. A statute might be on the books, Your Honor, for 10 or 15 or 20 or 50 years, and as time develops and as the regulated industry develops and changes, what may not have been an ambiguity or open texture within that statute becomes open texture. The key is when...
We call that the uninsured motorist statute.
But the key for us is when the agency is required to exercise its discretion in implementing a statute in a way that substantively affects the rights and obligations of the regulated public. The regulated public has an opportunity to be heard in the exercise of that discretion, how they're going to do this.
Is it your view then that any statute that requires discretion by the agency can only be implemented after regulations have been adopted?
If the statute is going to apply to a class of persons or entities, and the manner in which the agency proposes to implement it is going to substantively affect the rights and obligations of that class of persons or entities, absolutely. And besides that, in our view, being just plain fair and just, it also, if you think about it, it boils you right back down into the definition of regulation under the Administrative Procedures Act. Because a regulation is a statement of policy or procedure that's going to be used as a guide or a standard for the decision in cases thereafter. If the statute in question, whatever it is so vague that the administrative agency has to develop some sort of criteria or standard or guide, and it's going to impact the rights and obligations of the people who are subject to it, absolutely, regulation is a properly adopted regulation is required.
But wouldn't that mean that just about any time a statute calls for the assessment of either a fine or some fee for virtually any activity, since that amount, that dollar amount, can be fixed in a range of numbers, that means that it's got to be done by regulation. Every statute that says, and if they pay late, you know, you can assess a fine. Okay, now we have to have a regulation to determine what the fine is?
I think the difference there is that you don't, in a statute like that, you don't automatically have an entire class of persons or entities that are subject to it. What we have here are tax brackets. What you're talking about, Your Honor, I think is a little bit different. There you have a question where there could be an endless degree of factual circumstances involving the violation of a statute or a regulation that gives rise to the fine. And that's really where you get into a pure case decision, where the agency is going to look at the facts and circumstances of that particular case and then decide what the appropriate fine is. But if we're looking at an assessment of a fee over an entire class of persons, then that exercise of discretion really needs to be published in the form of a regulation so the entire class of persons can be heard.
Let's clarify that if we can. Suppose the statute in this case simply said that there will be a base fee payable by all of the regulated parties of $20,000 a year. You don't need a regulation to implement that, correct?
No.
It's self-executing.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is no discretion that the agency would then
All right.
Be permitted to.
Suppose, on the other hand, the statute said that the regulated parties will pay an annual base fee in an amount that the agency determines is fair, taking into account factors A, B, C, D, and E, and they're all enumerated specifically in the statute. What then?
I think in that case, you are going to need a regulation. That would be our position.
That would not lend itself to a case adjudication?
I guess it depends on the specificity of the standards. If there were five precise standards and it was only those standards that the agency could...
Well, suppose that were the case.
I think perhaps then there would no longer be the exercise of discretion with respect to the application of that statute to everybody. Here, it's a different story.
I don't want to prevent you from finishing your answer to Justice Jacobs' question, but you did want to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I completed my answer. Thank you.
Could you finish it?
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Valerie Chesmedia, and I represent the Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. The real question in this case is whether the Secretary, a specially qualified Secretary of the Environmental Agency, was required to adopt a regulation before it could categorize the 147 large stationary sources of criteria air pollutants in Delaware. The implication of the answer is the question that you seem to be focusing on, is whether all administrative agencies must adopt regulations before they can follow any specific directive from the legislator in the law, and whether it may exercise any discretion without a regulation. And the state presumes, the state believes that in this case, this statute is specific and self-executing, and even though it does allow some discretion, there is no requirement that every time discretion is exercised by the agency, that there must be a regulation adopted first to guide it. In this case, this law was entitled to last for 3 years. It did sunset and was reenacted for another 3 years. It's a short-term statute, and the purpose of tracking the hours that was, let me say that better. Part of this package in enacting this scheme was to make sure that the polluters bore the costs of this. These are all people who are emitting criteria air pollutants in Delaware's air. And they came up with this scheme to do it. And this was what they set upon, the user fee and the base fee. And they did it to try to more appropriately apportion the costs. Before, it had been set strictly on emissions. If your emissions were this high, you paid this much money. And they decided that wasn't fair because some sources were complicated and took up a lot of resources of the state. And so that person, if they took up a lot of time and energy from the department, they should pay more than someone who took very little resources in terms of review, but had a higher emission level. So they tried to split the baby and put half of it on the amount of pollutants that you use, and the other part of it based on the amount of services that you use. So the legislator set out what your fee would be based on your emissions, and then also directed the department to estimate the amount of services that would be used by the facilities. And then they gave them a further guide. They said if you're a voluntary synthetic miner, if you have agreed to reduce your emissions beyond a bottom limit, then you'll pay this much money. And then if your emissions are up to 400 hours, then you'll pay this much. And then if from 401 to 625, you'll pay this much. And what they were directed to consider specifically are permit issuance and renewals, and these are 3 to 5 year term permits, so they do expire relatively frequently. They're stationary source regulation development, ambient monitoring, emissions inventories, control strategy development, and they were also to include the cost of developing, administering and implementing two other programs, a small business stationary source technical and environmental compliance program and an accidental release prevention program. So as Your Honor pointed out, the Secretary was directed to make an estimate of the amount of time that he thought would be utilized by the people. And they use the term the hours spent.
Excuse me, utilized over what period of time?
Well, they didn't specify in the statute, but what they said was spent. And the way that the secretary interpreted that was the amount of time that had been spent on the permit to date.
Isn't that the kind of decision that should best be formulated through the regulatory process?
It is a decision that could be formulated through the regulatory process.
Why doesn't it have to be formulated through the regulatory process?
Because it was pretty specific. It said the hours spent. This program hadn't been in effect that long. And so there was a relative, there's a small universe. When you say spent, you're already specifying a specific amount of time.
Now, when you say this program, are you talking about from when this version of Title V was enacted or back to 96 or back to, was it 91? I'm not sure what the first date was.
I'm not sure what the first date was,
so
was either.
Can you tell me what time frame the hours are calculated on? Or estimated, rather?
I know it's in the record. I can't point to that at the moment.
More importantly, it's not important how long. The question I have is, how did anybody know how far back to go?
I believe actually what they took was, I'm looking at the opening brief at FB International on page 6, and it points out that they used the amount of time that was spent on that person's permit. So you're taking the universe of time that was spent on their permit, and in this case it was between 96 and 99.
Why was it from 96 to 99?
That's when FP International applied for a permit.
So in other words, if some permit holder had had a permit since 1980, let's say, hours would be counted from 1980 for that permit holder?
Well, I don't think that the program went back that far.
Let's say 1990, whatever the date is.
And I do know that the recommendation for this permit fee was set up from a committee that was comprised of people that have Title V permits. So there was some understanding of this process. I can't tell you exactly what the hours were then, but this was language that was developed in conjunction with the stakeholders. So somebody had an idea of what spent meant, and they had also, at when the committee subcommittees were working on it, the Chamber of Commerce, which had involved the industry, they had attached an estimation of what categories people would fall into. So there was some idea of what was being discussed.
When you say stakeholders, do you mean persons or entities regulated?
I believe they were involved. This is the Chamber of Commerce, which generally looks out for the interests of the business people. And my understanding is, my belief is, although I could confirm that to the court at a later date, that it did involve people who had Title V permits.
But I got the impression from your comment that it, if there was committee input from, quote, stakeholders, close quote, does that mean simply people who are regulated or people who believe they have a stake in the or an interest in the outcome of the process, which could include gratuitous, charitable, environmentalist, or interested homeowners in the community? I mean, what do stakeholders really mean?
When I used it in that term, I was referring to the Chamber of Commerce, which I don't necessarily believe involves a lot of what you would term enviros, or just people who live near there. I believe it tends
enviro
to be
sounds like something
have,
from high school biology. I have no idea what an enviro is.
I'm sorry. I wasn't referring to people who just have an interest and have made it known that they have an interest in protecting the environment. I think I was referring more to people who had an interest in having a permit and have an interest in the business, the community, and Delaware.
So when you say you're referring more to them, this committee that had input was exclusively people who would be regulated?
I believe it was exclusively people who could or would be regulated.
One of the issues that we're grappling with is how to characterize the nature of the action that the agency took here, because from that characterization flows whatever the procedural requirements are for accountability of that agency to individual regulated parties. I understand your position that what was involved here is not a regulation within the meaning of the Administrative Procedures Act. And I understand your side's position to be that although the statute is self-executing, it also gives the agency some discretion. So what do we have here, a case adjudication?
We have looked at that question as carefully as we can, and what we've argued all the way along is that it's more akin to a case adjudication. It doesn't fit squarely within that definition, but the case decisions,
okay,
the agency doesn't fall under case decisions for purposes of the APA.
If that's what it is, then what is the consequence of the agency's deciding, for example, that this particular regulated party has to pay a base fee of $20,000? That is, before whom does the agency have to justify that determination, and how does it justify it? What's the standard?
Well, in this case, what they did do was when they were contacted, and they were contacted by approximately 30 sources, they gave them...
When they're
challenged, then it would be whether they were arbitrary and capricious. And the lower board and the courts have looked at the evidence and looked at the hours and found that they did not believe that the agency was arbitrary and capricious. This is a specially qualified agency who's uniformly applied the criteria that was set out in the statute, and their estimates, which is what they were directed to do by the legislator, were verified. It's a matter of historic fact that they took and verified those hours. And I've heard FP International argue that that could include secretarial time, but the time in the record is not secretarial time. Your Honors, if you look at the names of the people, Mr. Mirzakhali, who's the air administrator, Tapandaz, who's a program person, so is Joanna French and Brian Klotz. As a matter of historical fact, the secretary did not include secretarial time, but rather program person time.
Excuse me, do you agree that all action taken by the secretary would have to either be in the form of a regulation or a case decision?
I do not. I just say that respectfully because I know that the Supreme Court in the Christiana case did make that statement. But I would argue to Your Honor that was dicta. In that case, the court found it to be a regulation and they were subject to regulation, so there was no need for the court to make that holding. I believe that there are self-executing statutes where the agency just follows the statute, and there I pointed out one example, and it may be of that type in the record in my brief, where the secretary is just empowered to do some things, and some things don't fit within those definitions.
And is it your position that this is one of those things that doesn't fit within either definition?
Squarely, yes, Your Honor. Although if one had to pick a category, I believe it certainly is closer to a case decision than that of a regulation.
Although what you've described as the process that the agency went through sounds an awful lot like kind of a mini regulatory process in terms of seeking input from the regulated parties and gathering necessary information from which to set up a formula.
Well, and I may have... Apparently, I've caused some confusion. When I was referring to that process, I was referring to the process of enacting the statute that set forth the criteria and the categories. The agency did not involve stakeholders in the actual, sorting people into the categories based on the criteria after the statute was already enacted.
Thank you.
In fact, the record shows that was done by Mr. Mirzakhali, with 17 years of experience in air quality program. Mr. Taggart, who has 30 years in that area. Ms. Terranova, with 10 years. So at the table, the record shows, were people with almost 60 years of experience who looked at the categories of the factors, the services that were set out in the statute, the permit issuance and renewal stationary source, and they just used their program expertise and made estimates. They weren't directed to count the hours. But when you go back and count the hours as a matter of historic fact, they verify the estimates that were made. And this information was provided to 18 other persons who wanted the verifications.
And it's fair to say their process was done entirely by people employed by the Department of Natural Resources.
Yes.
There were no, quote, stakeholders, close quote, at that table, as you put it.
Yes. Just Mr. Taggart, Mr. Mirzakhanali, and Ms. Terranova. As I pointed out in the brief, the factors that Mr. Mirzakhanali discussed that were considered at that table directly respond to the services set out in the statute. He said they considered the complexity of the source's emissions and control technology that relates to the length of time and complexity of permit issuance and renewal issuance, the need for emissions inventories and ambient monitoring, and the impacts of control strategy development. The other factors they considered, which are the applicable regulatory requirements and regulations, that directly relates to the statutory factor of stationary source regulation development, the complexity of the permit and the renewal issuance, the control strategy development, and ambient monitoring.
Does the record reflect why all those factors were chosen and became a part of the decision-making process without input from the regulated parties?
No. The record shows that they weighed these factors that relate to the program services and categorized the permittees. They certainly could have adopted a regulation, but those things do take time, and this is a short-term statute. And it would have been clearer what they were considering if they had adopted a regulation. But we might still be in the same situation, because AFSCME would have the choice to say that the state violated the regulation by not following it because of how they applied. I mean, this is a specific statute, and if you require the state to get down to such specific minutiae, it doesn't make a lot of sense when that's why you have specialized agencies with expertise to exercise their discretion in the first place. It's because the legislature doesn't necessarily have the expertise. And when you're looking at a short-term project, requiring them to put an awful lot of time and effort into trying to make it so explicit kind of obviates the need for people to know what their fee is going to be.
It obviates the need for the people that are paying the fee to know why and under what circumstances they're paying it. Is that what you're saying? We just put it in the hands of the administrators, because the legislature is not competent to do it, and let the administrators do it without input from the people that are paying the fee. That sounds fair to you?
I didn't mean it to sound that way. I meant it to sound that they set out very specific criteria, and then they applied them, and they were in the best position to apply them, and that people have recourse. We've already discussed the issue of whether it's more akin to a case decision than a regulation. I had argued below and would just like to point out that the case relied on by FP International Butler. In that case, the insurance commissioner had been expressly directed that they may promulgate regulations and or prerequisites which will establish reasonable standards and criteria for requiring additional or continuing education of licensees. In other words, in that case, they had spoken on this issue. They said, you may set out by regulation continuing education requirements. And in that case, the insurance commissioner chose to impose those type of requirements without having a regulation in place. A very different matter than the case we have here, where there's nothing said in the statute that the secretary needed to adopt a regulation. And in fact, it's very specific in what would be considered, as opposed to a general statement such as may promulgate regulations and or prerequisites which will establish reasonable standards and criteria for requiring additional or continuing education of licensees. That's a broad grant of authority, and it's one that includes a specific authority to adopt a regulation to govern that area. And in the case of Christiana versus Board of Education, the board, I believe, was specifically required to adopt regulations concerning the hours of daily school sessions and the days on which teachers may participate in educational activities. And then after being told that, I believe that they had to adopt regulations, they then changed it without adopting a regulation. And that clearly needed to have been done by regulation. It was a violation of the APA. The state does not believe that this case is the same as those two cases, where in the one case they were specifically directed in the provision to adopt regulations, and in the other case they said they may adopt it in a very general way. Does your Honor have any more questions that you wish me to address?
Thank you very much.
The discussion of Butler that Ms. Chismadia raised brings to mind a sort of an interesting point, and it goes to Justice Berger's question. Why wasn't it okay for the insurance department in the Butler matter to exercise its discretion about what it would take for Mr. Butler to get his license back and what would be appropriate to impose on Mr. Butler in order for the insurance department to decide that he was ready to be a licensed agent again? And the problem in Butler wasn't that the particular decision was arbitrary and capricious. The problem was that the department had an unwritten rule that applied to everybody in Mr. Butler's position. You're going to take 3 ethics courses if you want your license back. So it wasn't that this was an individual set of facts that was, or an individual remedy that was only appropriate to Mr. Butler. The problem is that the department applied this unwritten rule to everybody in his situation. And that's what's happening here. This isn't, this fee isn't percolating up from some individual and very special case decision or a decision on a fine. This unwritten criteria applies to everybody that's subject to the base fee statute. And the same risks that apply in Butler apply here. It wasn't that Butler said, I was treated differently than Agent John Doe, who only had to take 2 courses. The problem was, without that requirement being set out in a written regulation, the procedural safeguards to protect Butler and everybody else in his shoes from that possibility was absent. That's what's happening here. We don't have a written set of guidelines, a written regulation to give us the parameters for this estimate. So when Ms. Chismadia talks to you about, well, you know, we told him it was 522 hours, and that's the reference she makes in our brief, what that is the actual hours they said justified or verified the estimate that they had previously made. But without the parameters for the estimate, that actual hours verification is meaningless. It's out there in the ether. I could send a letter to everybody tomorrow just about and say, hey, tallied up all those hours we spent on you, and guess what? You're over 625 hours. How do I do that? By expanding out the time in which I'm going to count those hours. So the actual hours verification is meaningless until we first set up the parameters for the estimate. Whose hours are we going to include in the estimate? Whose are we going to exclude? How long a time frame are we looking at? Only once you have those parameters is the actual hours verification going to mean anything. There was a discussion in Ms. Chismadia's presentation about stakeholders. And I think she may have corrected herself, but I want to make sure the court understands very clearly that there were a few members of the industry involved in the Chamber of Commerce's recommendation. The vast majority of them weren't. But the critical thing is that none of them had any input into the development of the criteria to be used to rank the sources. And that's exactly what the Chamber of Commerce said to DENREC in its recommendations. We took you at face value in developing our recommendations, but you've got to publish the criteria that you use to establish these rankings in order to gain industry acceptance. They didn't do that, and they should have done that. Ms. Chismadia tells you that, well, the secretary didn't include all those secretarial services and other services that Mr. Teacher was talking about. That begs the question, why not? Should he have considered an allocation of secretarial services? Should he have considered an allocation of his own time in this estimate? And what would that have done to where each source falls out in these rankings. I don't know. I can't tell you that. But what I can tell you is it would have changed things. And so the question of whether or not it's appropriate to include an allocation of secretarial time or an allocation of the secretary's time is something, indeed, that the secretary's got to figure out. But because it could drastically change who pays what fee, the public, the regulated public, has a right to be involved in that process. I see I have 13 seconds left, so...
Well, tell us the implications if you prevail. Does it mean that all fees that anyone has ever paid would be refunded because they weren't paid pursuant to a proper process, or does it mean that they now do it right, and once the criteria are established, everyone will pay the fees retroactively?
I think, Your Honor, that at a minimum, that there is one of three fees that all sources are going to have to pay that aren't synthetic miners. So at a minimum, everybody would need to pay the fee set for the routine category. The
other because that part of the statute is self-executing.
Absolutely. It's not as if there's a part of the statute that says you can pay zero.
Tell me, again, if you prevail, what do you see as the implications?
I'm not sure. Obviously, I know what the implications are for my client because we chose to challenge it. For everybody else out there, if I was sitting in Ms. Chismadia's shoes, I would argue, hey, you had your chance to argue about this and you didn't do it. Or, you know, why are you here? We haven't...
So it would be a waiver for the people who have paid the fees.
I suspect, I honestly, it's a tough question for me to answer, Your Honor.
And if we conclude that you're right and they should adopt some regulations, do you agree that they could apply retroactively, or is that something you
I don't like
to think about?
I don't think they could apply retroactively. I don't think the statute would, the APA would permit that.
Thank you very much, counsel. Take the case under advisement.